Welcome, everyone, to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 207. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, John Lindemann.
Oh, my God, we're back again.
Greg Lay.
Hello.
And James Jones.
Hi.
Yes, we are here to talk to you about some Nintendo mess. A lot of DS games today on the new business, and then some really good listener mail coming up after the break. So, to kick us off, James.
Oh, no.
Tell me about the hot new mess on DS.
Yeah, so...
What are the kids playing out on the street these days?
Hopefully not this. So Storm City Games, my number 476,028th favorite publisher, has sent us a review copy of Monkey Madness Island Escape, a game that is so made by Storm City Games that it doesn't feel the need to tell you how to play it or what your objective is. So, Monkey Madness Island Escape, because although Monkey Madness is would seemingly be the title, Island Escape is the larger text, making me believe there are other Monkey Madness-related paraphernalia.
Plan Trilogy.
Oh, God. Oh, God, don't even joke about that.
It's episodic content.
Oh, I have episodes. I have lots of episodes, thanks to this game. So, Monkey Madness Island Escape is basically it's a light gun game without a light gun. Instead, it has a stylus. So you aim with by dragging your stylus across the bottom screen to move your reticle on the top screen, and you fire by pressing A button.
Okay.
Not the A button, just A button.
Any button. Well, it worked for Star Fox.
That is the begin and end of the functionality of this game.
It's very casual.
Very casual. Casually bad. So, like I said, when you start the game and you select a single player, the game just starts. Mm-hmm. You're just going. So, it took me a few minutes to figure out what the hell I'm supposed to be doing, because as I'm going around these poorly rendered settings of a jungle paradise, I'm having shit thrown at me by monkeys.
Like they don't literally throw shit, do they? Yeah.
They throw bananas, which also happen to be your form of health.
Wait, they throw health at you?
No, they throw bananas, but your health is also measured in bananas.
Oh, that's confusing.
Yes, it is, because it's hard to tell what your health is measured in, because it's a little graphic at the bottom of a monkey eating bananas. Because fuck this game. So I died a few times and didn't know how to tell how much health I had left. It's a very non-digital bushel of bananas that as it depletes because the monkey is eating it indicates that you're dying.
Okay. Woohoo!
You shoot these monkeys with a squirt gun, which apparently kills monkeys.
Uh-huh.
And then
well known. It worked on the flying monkeys.
Yeah, and then you collect weapons to power-ups that have a certain number of shots to put them down in a more timely manner.
So you get a super soaker.
You get like coconut gun. You get a coconut gun.
Oh, from Donkey Kong 64.
It fires in spurts, and if it shoots you, it's going to hurt. Yes, exactly.
Uh-huh.
This game is... I mean, there's just nothing fun about it. I mean, after playing it for like 5 minutes, I'm like, all right, I've seen everything this game has to offer. That is a problem.
What is the graphical style here? Is it pre-rendered? Are there polygons?
It's polygonal and ugly. Those are your two graphical styles I would use to describe this. There is some hand-drawn stuff in the menus and things, but it is also ugly. I would equate it to third-grade sketches.
So there's like a 3D world, and your character or whatever is moving through this world,
kind
of?
There are 3D sprites that you scroll along in, basically. So a lot of your movement is either sideways as you move through these shooting galleries or into the shooting galleries. You don't have any control over it, obviously.
Right. That the DS can't handle that.
That's no, the DS can't handle movement. It's right. Too much. It does have wireless card play, multi-card, rather, if you find someone who wants to play this game with you. You won't.
Well, I mean, light gun games are, you know, traditionally two-player.
Yeah, I mean, there's just nothing fun about the game. So I kill a bunch of monkeys, and then I kill a bunch of monkeys that are dressed, for whatever reason, as mummies. So they're mummy monkeys.
Okay.
Yes, they throw rocks at you. I don't know. I don't know if the shit's
monkeys.
Going on. Yes, there you go, monkeys. And then in the next stage, I shoot ninja monkeys once again. Fuck, I don't know what's going on here. And then the game freezes.
Ninkies.
Because in the middle of ninja monkey stage, it has frozen twice now.
Ooh.
Now, mind you, the game is still playing, but the graphics aren't updating, so you can still die. And you will die because you're being hit, although you can't see what the fuck is going on. So that is the extent of my experiences with Monkey Madness Island Escape. I expect I'm going to give it somewhere in the 8 to 10 range.
So you have a repeatable freeze bug in this DS retail game.
It has happened twice, yes.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure what conditions cause it to happen, but it has happened twice.
Have you made it past that?
Yes, but I died, so it didn't save my progress.
So it is possible to get through there
yeah,
without
so,
freezing.
Well, here's what's weird, though. The first time I died, or the first time it locked up, I died, and I turned off the DS because I was in my fuck this game mode. Mm-hmm. Which Monkey Madness Island Escape doesn't have to do a whole lot.
Well,
to
that's just your natural persistent state of being.
No, that's not true. But Monkey Madness Island Escape does have the ability to get me there faster than the average game. Mm-hmm. Somewhere between Mystery Dungeon and Miami Nights.
High praise, high praise.
What was interesting though is when I restarted the game, I selected single player, continue, and it started me right where I died last time, which the game doesn't normally do.
Whoa.
That I can see. It was still frozen, and I died again.
Wait! You continued into a freeze state?
Yes.
That's bizarre.
Yeah. And then
that is really weird.
It doesn't make any sense because then when I continued the next time, it started from the beginning of the level again. I'm like, what the fuck just happened? I'm scared. I then proceeded to turn this game off and possibly burn it. I'm not sure yet. So that's enough of this game until mm-hmm. I have to write the review, which will be mournful. I might call it even painful. Let's see. What else did I put on the list of games I want to talk about? Because I played a bunch of games this week, and I'm going to spare you some of the less savory ones. I purchased on Xbox Live Arcade for the first time. I played Rez, and I beat the entire thing in a single sitting.
That is, okay, this is really weird coincidence, because just in the past couple of days, I've been thinking that I should go buy Rez HD.
Yes.
Because, I don't know, for sort of just seeing all the Child of Eden stuff and hearing about it, I thought, you know, I played the demo for Rez HD, which is just the first level, and I guess that's, everybody says that's the most boring part of the game. And I never really gave it a chance. I've never really played Rez. So I was thinking, you know, for $10, I should maybe just go check it out. What do you think?
I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed
it. It's pretty cool, yeah.
It's kind of weird how this game happened to be in my possession, because I was discussing Rez with a very adamant fan of the game. But it came up because we were discussing Ikaruga, and I was like, maybe I should just go get Ikaruga. I've got Microsoft points sitting around.
You've played Ikaruga, though, right?
Yeah, but I don't have a copy of it with me right now.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's a fine way to spend $10 on your Xbox. But
and then they were like, well, you should just get Rez. I'm like, okay.
Well, they're like polar opposite, though, aren't they? I mean, Ikaruga is hard as balls, and Rez is... Isn't Rez kind of like a, you know, like an automatic win?
You can lose in Rez. I mean, it's not hard, but I mean, you can lose.
Yeah.
I mean, and I lost a couple times, but I mean, it's pretty simple. Mm. But what I was really shocked by was the fact that I basically played through that whole fucking game in like two sittings. Yeah. I was like, let's do this shit. Yes, I'm enjoying this greatly.
Well, what everybody says about Rez is I guess there's five levels, right?
Yeah, there's a fifth one you have to unlock.
The last level is apparently where the game really comes together and becomes like mind-blowing.
Yeah, that's where the game just gets super fucking trippy.
Okay.
I mean, that's like the crazy shit goes down in that level. And then the final boss is madness. I mean, it's really an experience of a game, let's put it that way.
I'm down with that. I like experience games.
And what I'm surprised to find out is that while it does not support the infamous trance vibrator.
No. That's a Dreamcast.
Unsold.
Well, hold on. It does let you connect additional 360 controllers to fill that void.
Mm.
Right.
Thank goodness.
They become vibrators.
Yes.
I mean, they become vibrators.
Yes,
that's what they are.
They do. They are. Yeah.
They vibrate. They are things that vibrate, and that's all they do.
Yes, and that is the official name for the original peripheral, so we can use that term.
It's called massagers, guys. Massagers.
It's not called the trance massager, John. Hmm. That's the game that you downloaded.
Enjoy your massager?
If you ever go to the Xbox indie games, there's tons and tons of massage programs, because I guess it's kind of like a tech demo thing. I guess if you're learning to program...
Enjoy them.
If you're learning to program in XNA, like the first thing you learn is how to activate the controller and do weird things with it.
Activate it.
Really easy to program a massage program. It's totally pointless, but there's tons of these. And it's getting to the point where there's so many of them, they're starting to get parodies. And I saw one of the newer Xbox indie games is like Zombie Extreme Massage.
Cool.
Just combining all these silly cliches. I didn't play it, of course, but I thought it was a funny name, at least.
You should have bought it.
So, James, did you use the vibrating?
I did
extra
not
controller?
Because my other 360 controller is somewhere, and I do not know where it is at the moment. But
supposedly, it's using the vibrator, you know, the extra accessory stuff to vibrate. you know, you're supposed to put it like on your leg or your shoulder or behind your head or whatever, and it's supposed to like help you lock into the rhythm of the music and help you play the game better, or at least experience the game better.
I found that playing this game with the lights off was a bit too, like, you really get locked in because the light, I mean, the actual lights of the game flicker in sync with the rhythm and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But it's really hard to play that game like that because your eyes start to bleed.
Oh, okay.
I really think that if you've not played that game, you really should give it a shot. I mean, it is a whole lot of fun. I mean, it's not real long. Like I said, I beat it in a few hours of gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
The person I was talking to was kind of surprised how fast I beat it, but, you know, it's not really that hard. You know, it was either that, Ikaruga, or Monday Night Combat, which, you know, I'll probably get around to all three of them eventually.
Did you think about Hydro Thunder?
I did, but I was never a huge fan of the Hydro Thunder.
Try the demo.
Well, I'll get through the other two first, and then I'll consider Hydro Thunder. I mean, that's only the, like, third Xbox Live arcade game I've downloaded.
You don't have Geometry Wars 2?
I have the original.
Two is a whole different league.
Yeah, two is where the players play.
That's right.
Jesus Christ, John. So I've got one more game. I'll be quick since we've talked about it before. And that is, I finally got my freaking copy of Jam with the Band.
Yay.
Because it came in the same envelope as Monkey Madness Island Horror. So after I bleached the cover clear, I really actually enjoy this game. I played a lot of it. I put a lot of time into it. It's a fairly casual game, but you can really get locked into it as you're playing.
It came in time for the download service to actually be working again.
Yay! My copy's been in the States for like a month and a half, but it finally got sent to me, so it's an exciting moment for me personally. What I found is, musically, the game actually does a really good job of assigning the melody, the various accompaniment positions, rhythm positions, and when you actually play those roles in the instrumentation, you can actually get a feel for what it's like to play accompaniment, melody, percussion, rhythm. And as a violist, I know all about playing everything that's not the melody. But
right.
I found that the practice mode in this game is actually really effective. It's very similar to how you're taught to practice as a musician. I mean, you can slow it down. You can have it stop when you miss a note. You can play sections and then come back and play them over and over again. So what I did was, there's the year gig mode, basically. The daily gig, or whatever they call it. And I kept getting this one song, and I can't remember what it is now. And I kept failing the same freaking song over and over again, which would mean I'd have to go back and... So I think it was at level 3, and it was trying to play me level 4 music. I kept getting booted back to level 2 by level 4 music. Which is the biggest pain in the ass. It's like, okay, you're level 3. Here's level 4. Oh, you're back to level 2 because you didn't do great at this level 4.
It was that bad. You've got to go all the way down.
Yeah, so I basically went and practiced the song until I could do it basically with my eyes closed, and went through and didn't get that fucking song.
Yeah, because it's kind of random.
First time. I mean, I had played that song on steel drums. I had played it on a saxophone. I had played it on the distortion guitar. And then I come through, didn't get that song. In fact, I went straight 3, 4, 5. I went through 3 levels on what, 1 gig. And missed that song entirely. I was so mad.
Quick clarification. Playing different instruments doesn't... The mechanics are the same no matter what, right?
Yeah, but the difference is that songs have... I mean, there's some songs where the instrument doesn't work real well, so hearing the song played that way can kind of screw you up. So, like, if you're playing the Super Mario melody, which is... First off, I want to point out that all the Nintendo melodies are, like, unnecessarily difficult. It's like Nintendo would be like, our music's better than this music. It's going to be hard as shit.
Well, a lot of those classic Nintendo songs are actually just difficult to play. I mean, the Super Mario theme, for instance, is very jazzy and has a kind of an unusual meter. It's not easy to play on any instrument.
But there's no syncopation. It's just got a very strange beat pattern.
Yeah.
And what's funny about it is it's like, well, we're going to make our shit hard as hell. Fuck you. Like, even the transitions are kind
of
crazy.
Yeah, because there's medleys. There's a lot of F-Zero medleys.
The F-Zero medley is just madness, and the Zelda one's even worse. I mean, the Zelda one's like, you're going to play the melody and the percussive notes at the same time. Fuck it. It's like, you just can't win that one. But playing Mario on a Koto, it is just weird. I mean, because it's just a
Koto?
A Koto is a Japanese stringed instrument that you rest on the ground. It's basically a long piece of wood with strings stretched across it.
Mm.
It has a very distinct sound.
Yeah, there is some, like, there are some touch-driven instruments you can play that way, like, you know, you're sort of strumming strings for guitar or the playing keys by touch.
Right.
But you won't come across those very often in, like, the gig mode or anything.
No. What I found is that, like, as I got, as I played these songs, I was able to anticipate what the next note they were going to have me play was, which was good because that meant I could actually start scanning ahead. So yeah, it's the same sensation I get when actually playing an instrument and learning a new song, which I've never really seen captured in a music game before. So I kind of appreciated that.
Wait for Rock Band 3.
Yeah, well, I'm not gonna pay for a real freaking guitar to play.
Yeah, so is Jam with the Band somewhat more cost effective?
Slightly, yeah, but Rock Band 3 has Yoshimi.
Even leveraging the massive cost of importing the title, I could still buy like 40 copies of it, shipping them individually for the cost of buying the whole Rock Band 3 kit.
Well, I mean, that's...
Well, right now the game is practically -$5 to buy it, so I mean...
They're going to start paying you to take it off their hands.
All right, well, I'll go next, and I've had a friend in town, haven't had a lot of time to play games. The one game that I've played quite a bit, because it's portable and I can kind of squeeze it in almost virtually anywhere, is Dragon Quest IX. And I've played a hell of a lot of Dragon Quest IX. I'm at about 55 hours right now, and it's not...
Junior.
I think I'm getting pretty far into the main quest, but I've spent tons of time doing side stuff too, like really optional side quest stuff. A lot of gathering alchemy ingredients just because I want to make cool things with alchemy. A lot of exploring the world and getting to places that I probably shouldn't be at yet, but, you know, I just kind of want to find little secret nooks and crannies because I got the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Dragon Quest IX is brilliant. I mean, it is certainly as good as any of the Dragon Quest games. There are things that I think Dragon Quest VIII did better on the PS2. For instance, I think the world is more fun to explore in Dragon Quest VIII because, for one thing, it's 3D, so it's a little more exciting to see it. You know, when you find a new area, there's just kind of more to look at. And in Dragon Quest VIII, there are treasure chests hidden all over the map. So you're actually really rewarded for kind of going into the corners and looking behind things, and, you know, you really feel like you're discovering things, kind of like that Zelda feeling when you find, like, a secret area and there's a treasure chest there. And in Dragon Quest IX, there are no treasure chests on the world map. There are little sparkly things where you can get items, like alchemy items, but those are it's pretty easy to look at the map on the top screen and see where those are going to be. So there's not that much sense of discovery. It's more like, you know, I go to this area, I look on the map, oh, there's a town here, and there's a little clearing here where I can get some alchemy stuff. So the world, exploring the world is not as exciting. And the other thing is that Dragon Quest VIII had these super monsters that you could see on the screen. Now the difference is, back in VIII, the regular encounters were random, invisible.
Ugh.
So, the kind of traditional Japanese style.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you could see enemies on the map, and those were like the super monsters. And they're really hard, but you get crazy stuff when you beat them, and then later in the game you can actually go recruit those guys and do like this monster battle mini game with them, which was a lot of fun. So, it was really exciting to just go around an island and look around and search for these roaming super monsters, and then try to figure out how to beat them. That's not in Dragon Quest IX either. So, unfortunately for me, exploring the world in itself is not that exciting anymore. But what it does have in the new one is these quests where you talk to certain NPCs. They'll have blue text balloons over their heads, and that means they have a quest to give you. And the quest will sometimes be, bring me a couple of items, and you may already have them, so that's nothing. Sometimes it'll be, go talk to so-and-so and get something from them and bring it back to me. Sometimes it'll be, go fight a certain number of monsters and kill them in this very specific way. And the quests are really interesting, especially the combat ones, because they have you using abilities that you might not normally use, and kind of some of them actually kind of teach you ways to beat monsters that you might not know about. But, I don't know. The problem with the quest is that you don't know what the reward's going to be before you finish it. And so far, a lot of the rewards I've found to be not that great. But the ones that are really exciting are the quests that open up new job changes for you, new vocations. Because the vocations are... This is something that Dragon Quest VIII didn't really have. And it's straight out of Final Fantasy Tactics or Final Fantasy V or whatever You know, you can change your job. And that brings a huge amount of grinding to the game, but also a lot of satisfaction. Because the thing is, what you can do is once you get to a point where it feels like you're having to grind a lot to gain a level, you know, like you've kind of gotten to an area and you're no longer getting a whole lot of experience relative to your level. Mm-hmm. What you can then go do is change everybody's vocation and it resets them to level one. Now you'll still have all this advanced equipment and a lot of their abilities will carry over from their previous job, including stuff like plus 10 hit points or plus 10 strength. So it's not like they're weaklings, but they go back to level one, which means that you can now go back to where you were before and fight the same monsters and get tons of level ups because they're starting from scratch. And so what it means is that for a given area, you can actually very quickly level up in multiple jobs and build up a lot of skill points to buy abilities that will carry across all jobs. And so you can build up these really complex sets of abilities and attributes from a lot of different jobs. You can mix and match and create unique characters that really kind of exhibit all the qualities that you want. So I can have a mage who also is really good at using swords and has the ability to steal like a thief. You know, and that I can create that in 30 minutes if I go to the right place. So it's really nice because, you know, I mean, the downside is that the characters you have are kind of just vanilla, you know, they're kind of randomly generated at the beginning of the game. So they don't really have any personality, but you can sort of imbue them with your own kind of imagination. You know, it's not like I'm writing dialogue for them, but in terms of how they're used in combat and what they can do, they are individualized, and I've sort of determined what they can do. And so they, you know, when I think about, I have a character in my party named Jessica, and she's like the healer. And she can do other things too, because every now and then I switch her to other jobs and pick up a few abilities, but primarily she's the healer. And she is that way because I made her that way. So it's nice because it does give you a lot of the customization that you might associate with Western RPGs. You know, your Fallouts and your Mass Effects and things like that. But you're not like rolling attributes at the beginning of the game or something like that. You build it up over time based on how you want to play. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing secret about it. I mean, they get everything. That's a big problem I have with Western RPGs is a lot of times, you know, it's like at the beginning of the game, they say, how many of these skill points do you want to put towards charisma? It's like, I don't fucking know what charisma does. What does that mean? How would I know? And then maybe later I might not be able to change that. If I decide that I didn't like that, I might have to start the whole game over. And that is impossible in Dragon Quest IX.
You could just kind of feel your way through it.
Yes, and the game is very upfront about this class does this, this, and this, and can use these kinds of weapons. And before you devote your skill points to different things, it's pretty obvious what they're going to unlock. It tells you the name of the ability that's going to unlock. So you know ahead of time what you're getting into. So you can make informed decisions. And I, you know, I like that a lot. But man, the game is so addictive because it's always providing you these little small chunk opportunities to do something and get rewarded for it in a specific way. And they don't take that long, like finishing a quest or going out to find something to alchemize a cool weapon. And it just... the time to do all this is small per task, but it adds up so fast. And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, I played this game for 6 hours today and I'm super busy. How did this happen?
So it's effectively an offline MMO.
So what you do is kind of comparing it with 8 earlier. What do you think the portability has brought to the experience?
It just makes it easier to
put those little bits of time in.
Right. And the thing is, I feel like my average play session with 9 is probably just as long as it was with 8.
Yeah, but conceptually, it doesn't have
right.
to be.
Right. It takes less of an effort to turn it on and to get and to jump into it because it's on DS. Whereas with Dragon Quest 8, I primarily played that game during a Christmas vacation. So I was playing it like 8 hours a day where I woke up in the morning. I had every intention of playing Dragon Quest until I was ready for bedtime. Mm-hmm. I was visiting home that vacation and my mom was like screaming at me to come up and eat dinner. That's the kind of game that Dragon Quest 8 was. And I put over 100 hours into that. So Dragon Quest 9 seems to be at least as long as 8, you know, have at least as much stuff. But it's definitely more about building up your characters and less about the story. Because in Dragon Quest VIII, the characters have predefined abilities and they have personalities, and it's much more story driven. It's much more plot driven. It's like, I know that the next place I have to go is somewhere over there because the story has to move in that direction. My characters are looking for a certain item or something. And Dragon Quest IX feels like it's much more encapsulated. It has these little, this little chunk. You go to this one town and they have some problem and you solve that and you get your little golden fig fruit. And then now you can go move on to another town and do exactly the same thing. They're all very disconnected. A lot of them can be done in any order, so it's less linear.
Yeah.
But it also feels like there's not as much actual story. Like, it feels like I don't know what the point of the game is. I'm 55 hours into it. I don't know who the main bad guy is. I don't know where the story's going. All I know is I'm running around and getting these figs, and there's a bunch of them, and I've already gotten a lot, and that's not the reason. I'm playing it because I like building up my characters. I like getting the new abilities. I have no idea where the story's going. I don't even know how far. I might be halfway through the game. I might be 3/4. I have no idea. So yeah. It's not very directed in that way.
I mean, it lets you really meander off of the main story.
Oh, no
much,
shit.
Much like any MMO, you can just go off and do whatever the heck you want, which
at
can be good
at one time, I had four like major plot quests open at the same time.
Yep.
Each one culminating in a boss and getting one of these golden fruits and supposedly moving the story along.
Yeah.
But I had started four of them, and I was finally like, well, I guess I should finish one of these, kind of get things rolling again. But it's weird because you finish one of those and you don't really get, you get this golden fruit that has some kind of vacuous story importance that I don't understand. But you don't really get anything else. Like, you don't really get something to make your party better. You don't get a bunch of equipment usually. So it's like, I could go spend my time on that, but I'd rather spend my time doing these mini quests and killing these monsters and things like that, because I feel like I actually get more rewarded for doing that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a whole lot of incentive for me to go and finish the story quests. It's interesting. Very interesting.
I mean, if you've ever wondered about the appeal of something like World of Warcraft, that's just it. It's building up your character. I mean, you don't even have to follow a story or anything like that. I mean,
but I don't have to pay $15 a month.
Very, very true. But I mean, if you wonder why so many people play it, that's completely
And I've paid the same amount that I would for playing WoW 2 months, but then that's all I ever pay. I will say that I'm really hoping that Dragon Quest X goes back to the style of being a more linear, story-based thing and having a fully 3D world that's fun to explore for its own sake. Not because I don't like the way Dragon Quest IX is, but I feel like there's a value to kind of going back and forth and having it both ways.
Mm.
So I hope that I hope this isn't the new kind of Dragon Quest. I hope this is something they can go back to and keep trying to experiment with a little bit. But we'll see. John, you are next.
Well, whenever I want to look for a cheap game, you can just find a PSP game because nobody buys those things.
They just steal them if they actually want them.
Yep.
Right. You might be the only man in America who actually pays for PSP games.
Yeah, well, I had to, speaking of Dragon Quest IX, I had the $15 gift card from Toys R Us, and actually, I was really surprised. I went to a Toys R Us downtown south of here. Usually, the one up nearby me is usually picked pretty clean in terms of bargain stuff. But I went down to where the rich people are, and they don't buy PSP games like, apparently. So,
earning the creepy uncle moniker.
Exactly. So I just
go there for the bargains, really.
Anyways, I was checking out their wall. Oh, bargains, and I came across Little Big Planet for PSP, which is a game that I was looking at before. I was actually traveling a while back, and they had it for like $40 at the airport. And I'm just like, there's no way I'm ever paying $40 for any PSP game. But, I was curious because, I enjoyed it on PS3. So, but so I had the $15 gift card from Dragon Quest IX. And so I said, all right, I'll get it. It'll be $5. So I picked it up. And, it's funny because the one thing I will say about the PSP is like, every single game on PSP, I can just say, yeah, you know how the other game in the series that's on PS3? Yeah, it's almost exactly like that. And Little Big Planet is another case in which the only way I can describe it, the PSP version of it, is that it is the PS3 version shrunken down onto a PSP. There's really not a lot of difference.
It's just weird that the PSP seems to have very few exclusive games or franchises.
Yeah.
Like things that are only on the PSP.
Yeah, it's funny because
Patapon is one of those, and that's why that would be one of the first games that I would get.
Yeah.
That's that's just one of the reasons I haven't gotten a PSP, is because so many of the games seem to be just sort of diminutive versions of things that I can play on systems I already own.
Yep. And this, I mean, Little Big Planet, it's very good. You know, I checked it out, and it got really good ratings and everything, and I mean, it's a good game. It's a really good platformer, really, and on the PSP, there's really not too many straight-ahead platformers. You get a lot of, like, you know, Jak and Daxter kind of stuff, but really there's no real side-scrolling platformers on it. So, you know, it was good. It's good to have in that sense, but gameplay-wise, it's the PS3 version is very simple, so it's very easy to translate it to PSP. And, you know, you can download content. I haven't created any levels yet. I've played a couple of the created levels that are out there, some of the highly rated ones, and they kind of vary in quality. Usually where they kind of fall short is, you know, in actually explaining to you how to play the level, because there's always certain things that people try to do in their levels that are built around kind of shoehorning the functionality that's in the game into doing something else, like, you know, trying to control a spaceship by grabbing something and pulling instead of, you know, just kind of weird right. stuff like that, just goofy stuff like that you kind of have to figure out. But yeah, I mean, if you like Little Big Planet on the PS3 and you're dying for it in portable form, then yeah, I mean, the PSP version is just as good.
It's pretty good for $5.
Yeah, for $5, I'm not complaining. There's also a lot of downloadable content. A lot of it. It's what I thought was pretty funny is that because there's a lot of DLC out there, and I was like, you know, if you wanted to buy everything, how much would it cost? And there's like $60 worth of DLC out there for it. Like, just like various like costumes and
yeah, lots of costumes.
Yeah, like level building packs and stuff like that. And I was like, wow, man, that's a lot of money. I mean, Jesus.
I can't imagine it's great to build levels on though. I mean, with the interface of the PSP and everything.
I'll have to check it out and see. But I mean, it was kind of clunky on the PS3. So I'd imagine on the PSP.
Yeah, I've seen that's one thing that Move could actually make quite a lot better with the second one.
I think Little Big Planet 2 does support Move.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does, and I drag and drop and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it should actually make that part of it at least more streamlined. Although there's still the issue of creativity.
Hey, maybe they'll put real time strategy games on the PS3 now that they have Move. Oh wait, that never happened for Wii. It's not going to happen for them.
Yeah.
They've never had a DS.
Actually, you're wrong. That Ruse is coming out on the PS3 for Move.
Ooh.
It's also coming out on Xbox 360.
It is, but it will be probably much better to play on with the Move, because I've played it with the 360. It's kind of clunky.
Well, just to continue this tangent, I was thinking the other day, you know, I understand why some big studio hasn't tried to make a real-time strategy game for the Wii, because it seems like a mismatch with the demographic and yada, yada, yada. It's hard to make console RTS regardless of input. But it really surprises me that I haven't heard of anyone trying to do it on WiiWare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with full pointer controls and...
I don't think it's anything like full pointer controls. But doesn't Swords and Soldiers have some sort of RTS kind of element to it?
It is real time and it is strategic.
But it's not like a classic and it's a good style game. RTS.
No, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, it's like side scrolling, isn't it?
Right. The thing is, it's basically 1D. It's basically a 1D real-time strategy game, because you have no unit control over your guys. You make the guys, and then they go off and do automatic things.
They're fire and forget, basically.
Right. You basically just launch dudes. So it's all about build order and things like that, but you can't actually control your units tactically. So, yeah, it's Swords and Soldiers is far simpler than something like StarCraft. Far simpler. And it is still a good game. Don't get me wrong, I like Swords and Soldiers, but I'm just really surprised that no one has tried to do even, you know, I hear people say that, well, it's hard to do it with the graphics, you know, because you have small units. I'm thinking, if you're on like a WiiWare thing, and it's clearly experimental, mm-hmm. and it's $5 or whatever, I think you can get away with even doing like red and blue dots. Seriously, I mean, just strip it down to the bare minimum graphical elements, but have the gameplay be there. You know, get it to a point where the system can process as much as you want. And then once you've designed the game the way you want it, build up the graphics from there and make them as complex as the engine will allow for. And then whatever you end up with, those are the graphics. And I think that strategy players won't care if the graphics suck as long as the gameplay is there. And it shocks me that with the Wii Remote, with the pointing power of it, and even having the, you know, the nunchuck where you could use that to pan the camera around and do things mm-hmm. like that. Really surprising to me that no one has tried to make like a bare bones, cheap, real-time strategy game. There's a couple on the system. I mean, there's plenty of tower defense, which is again, a very highly simplified version of RTS. And then there's the, what was the Penguin game where it was kind of tower defense as well. But there really hasn't been anything, and it's strange to me because Wii is the first console that seems like the input method might actually work. And then you've got the whole WiiWare service where you have the space for experimental games, and yet instead you get massage.
So. Never know. Could be the shocking conclusion to the BitTrip series.
That would be great. That would actually be really cool.
Commander Video actually lives up to his name and starts bossing lots of little dots around.
Well, I mean, the problem with that is that RTS is very complex gameplay for BitTrip. They're so stripped down that I don't think that's going to happen. But it would be cool. Be a great aesthetic for it, you know. So anyway, Greg, why are you playing a Japanese mech game from 2006 on DS?
Well, it's actually a little bit of a funny story, this one. The story begins with me getting chiseled out of a copy of Chibi Robo Park Patrol on eBay.
Oh, that's the second one, right?
Yeah, it's the one. It was the Walmart exclusive Chibi Robo game.
Damn you, Meg Whitman!
with the environmental theme, but it never came out in Europe at all. And you know, it's not a lot of venues to get it.
There are a lot of copies of that floating around on the secondhand market that I could procure on your behalf.
If you're gonna get it at this point, it's got eBay. It's got a way to go. Everything looked good, and then I got sniped out of it. And then I was like, so I started looking at other kind of weird DS games to sort of soothe my deflated ego that you couldn't really get on any import stores or anything like that. And I thought about this Chosoju Mecha MG or Super Control Marionation Gear is sort of
that is what it translates to.
Marionation Gear.
It's a remote control robot.
So the thing is that this actually kind of became topical again, even though it came out in 2006, because of Zangeki no Reginlev.
Oh, the developers are the same.
Yeah, Sandlot, who made like Earth Defense Force 2017.
Yeah, that's right.
They made this game for Nintendo. Nintendo published it in Japan back in 2006. So, of course, Zangeki no Reginlev came out earlier this year in Japan, and looks like that's where it's going to stay.
Oh!
Oh, sorry, James. I'm sorry.
Well, you know, they're just... I think Nintendo of America is like, you know, one Motion Plus game per year is enough. We don't want to confuse the market.
We don't want to.
But is there a Motion Plus thing with Zelda that has been moved out? I mean...
That's right.
Flink Smash, yeah, you're right.
Which Flink Smash is optional.
No, I think it's exclusive now. They've made it... It was optional.
Oh, it was optional.
I think they've made it
They took out a mode just so they could justify the peripheral.
I've been 2 years where I've missed out playing the demos of Flink Smash. It sounds fun, though.
It is a game. I'll give it that much.
So go back to Chosoju Mecha MG. It completely passed me by in 2006.
Really? I can't imagine how.
Super Robot Marionette didn't get your attention?
Apparently not. there was also like a slight sort of bump for it in Brawl, because there's a song from it on the Norfair stage. Taken from the game, like a remix, and then I think there's like trophies and stickers and stuff. So ultimately, I just thought, that weird robot game, that might be on eBay. Probably not.
Weird robot
And then it was. It was on eBay, like perfect condition copy, really
cheap. You know how many fucking, quote, weird robot games there are on the DS in Japan? Right now I'm looking at the import page. I see six.
Yeah, well, it's just
out of 20 games, six of them.
It's just a total fluke. After losing out on Chibi Robo, I just thought, let's just put that name in. If anyone's actually spelled it the same way I'm spelling it, maybe that helped with no one else bidding on it. And then I picked it up and then started playing it after I'd read some pretty good impressions from the limited amount of information that's out there on it. And it's a really interesting and unique game from my point of view, at least, because I've never played anything remotely like it before.
Is it import friendly?
The gameplay is very import friendly. The core gameplay, because what you're doing with this is you're controlling the movement of these mechs with a D-pad, and then everything else is touch-driven. So you've got these, like, panels on the bottom screen with, like, levers and gears and missile triggers, all sorts of different things, different for each mech.
It's like Steel Battalion on the DS.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's like having, like, a bunch of virtual Steel Battalion controllers for, like, for each mech or whatever. And so you can kind of just intuit what everything does with a little bit of experimentation as well. So you don't really need to have a whole bunch of stuff explained to you in anything.
Well, you know, that's also how Steel Diver is controlled.
Exactly. It really did strike me as like the perfect kind of 3DS type thing, you know, where the touchscreen is just this sort of ancillary kind of interface thing. Mm-hmm. And then the slide pad would probably, you know, help a little bit with the controlling of the robot. So I think a 3DS sequel for Japan would probably go quite well. But the thing with it is that there's a lot of story in it. Loads. There's loads of cutscenes. Reams of dialogue and stuff, so that's why it's probably never even, I know it's like the most quintessentially Japanese thing ever, you know, callow youth pilots giant robots on journey discovery, but this amount of dialogue probably just completely killed it. I mean, you'd have to do like old school localization where you localize by cutting it out.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, you've got children, or maybe we should call them kildren.
Classic.
Slaughtering each other with their giant robots.
So, I don't really know what's going on with the story other than it's just like you start off as a rookie mech driver, essentially, and work your way up and do a bunch of different missions and eventually kind of amass a whole bunch of different mechs. And so you've got this mission structure to it where the missions, there's some variation in there. Sometimes you'll be just like destroy some enemies in a given part. Some will be like races, because a lot of the mechs transform into vehicles. You've got some where you're moving things or protecting things, working with other mechs. There's a decent amount of variation in there. But the biggest variation really comes from the mechs themselves, because you have got really quite a broad range of different kinds of mechs. Some are painfully slow. I mean, the whole game is very deliberate, and I think that's what really makes the touchscreen kind of controls work. Because you might think, well, it's all well and good, and it does allow for this like great diversity of control schemes by having all these different custom interfaces. But at the same time, you know, it is like a virtual control setup, and we kind of talked about some of the problems with that, like related to iPhone and stuff. Of course, with the stylus, it's not too bad, but because it's all so deliberate, you're not normally like that frantic about it. And in fact, there's in the game design kind of countermeasures against like spamming or doing anything crazy, because your robot will overheat if you do too much.
So you get cooldown.
And you become practically crippled if you overheat, so you really need to avoid doing that. So it's all very deliberate, very considered what you're supposed to be doing. But on the other hand, some of the robots sort of exemplify that a lot more than others. Like some can barely move, but they have devastating firepowers, while others are actually quite mobile and might rely on melee attacks. I mean, there's so much variety and they're so crazy. You've got like a bullet train transformer that wields a shotgun. You've got like a frog ninja thing. There's like so much crazy stuff in this game, and they all play, you know, sort of. I mean, there are some like palette swaps and upgrades and stuff, but like considering there's like 100 mechs in the game or something, there's a lot of variety in the different ways that you play the game.
I gotta tell you, Greg, everything you've said reminds me of a game that I reviewed on GameCube a long time ago called Gacha Force.
It is very similar to Gacha Force from what you're describing. Yeah.
Really? Yes. So James, have you played Gacha Force?
I have played Gacha Force.
Do you like it too?
I did like Gacha Force.
I am so glad to hear that. I thought I was one of the only people who actually
liked it. It has big robots that blow each other up. Have we not established that falls directly in one of the niches of games?
It definitely is in the James Jones wheelhouse for sure.
Yeah, well, just to follow up what you were saying about the variety, that is definitely the best thing about Gacha Force. I'm looking at my review right now, and I just want to quote a list here of the different kinds of robots that are in Gacha Force. Humanoid robots with guns and swords, industrial robots with huge arms and missiles, flying angels, huge dragons, nurses with giant syringes, jet fighters, aliens, laser-equipped satellites, flying fortresses, UFOs, ninjas and samurai, demons, tanks, and armored cars. How can you not love a game that pits any one of those against any one of the others?
What, no panda bears? Come on.
It sounds very similar to
this
what you're
talking
about.
This has got some of those covered, at least. I'm not so sure about the nurse, but
the nurse is my favorite character, actually.
It does feel great. Like, there's one mech I just picked up recently, which is like this transforming car that just like spins like an axe around. It is awesome when you sort of think, oh wow, I can actually attack stuff that's behind me rather than like turn. And you've got ones that's like really cool. So there's one that's just like a giant microwave emitter, and you have to flip all these switches on it to actually activate this huge dish, and then when it's on full power it just kills stuff instantly. Or like there's other ones where there's like a drill mech, and you attack with the drills, but you can actually in an emergency fire off the drill bit as a colossal missile, but you have to enter like a little code in to do it because it's so nuclear with the touchscreen. That's really kind of, I like the missions, they don't change that much, they just generally tend to scale up, so you'll start fighting more enemies and more difficult enemies and stuff. Mm-hmm. And of course you get better mechs that kind of balance that out, but they're not just better, they're different, and so it's always fun kind of discovering how they play. But the mission structure is actually kind of strange, because what's happening is you're kind of spreading out over this world map, which is like some weird Pangaea version of the real world where the pyramids are on the same continent as the Eiffel Tower. And
it's for ultimate destruction.
You could try each one of these missions on one of four difficulty levels, so if you were someone in Japan who really wanted to get into the story, you could just play the missions on the easiest level and see the game unfold that way without much of a problem. But if you're someone who is playing it on the import version, the story doesn't really mean much to you. What's kind of driving you forward is that if you complete each mission on higher difficulties, you'll unlock different stuff. First of all, you'll earn more money, you'll earn mech parts that you can build your own mechs from. So you've got these different difficulties really do scale up very drastically. I mean, from one to the next, there's a big, big difference. And what will happen is, at first, it's, you just kind of could be pretty indiscriminate. And then it's on the higher difficulties that you really do get into how to, like, so you have to, like, conserve your movement, not to overheat. You have to be really deliberate. And the thing is that can kind of go one of two ways. It's either really awesome when you take down this, like, really hard fight because you kind of really thought about it and you devised a plan and you executed it very specifically to win the fight. Or because the enemies have so much more health, and the damage kind of tilts against you, the battles can get slow to a point where it gets a bit painful. The slow pace of the game for me works fine in the context of these little chunks. All of these missions tend to be very quick, but when you scale up to the higher difficulties, all of a sudden they can go on for quite a while, and that's what, like I say, either it's kind of awesome or it's kind of boring. But like I said, it's almost like a buffet in terms of, like, if you like a particular mission, you can try and get all the medals on that and then use that money to buy better mechs. And if you don't particularly like one, well, you don't have to, you only have to beat it on the easiest setting to keep opening stuff up, and maybe you could come back to it on the harder settings after you get better mechs that would make it less tough going. It is a kind of nice structure in that sense. Quite odd, but it works for this game.
Cool. Well, that is Chosoju Mecha MG. I'm sure I butchered that, but...
Hold on.
It sounds like a pretty cool import title if the DS scene is drying up for you and you're looking to mine the back catalog. It sounds interesting to me, knowing that I have actually liked other games like that in the past.
And it'd be really cool. I guess the biggest thing in terms of, like, collecting better mechs, and you can upgrade the mechs and all this kind of stuff from beating all more missions, is it does have a multiplayer mode. And I can imagine that would be really cool if you had a friend with another copy of the game, and it's kind of like, oh, we put my best mech against your best mech or whatever, but that's never going to happen, is it, for someone importing the
but
game?
But you don't live in Japan.
That is a real shame.
Well, and he's 4 years too late.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't live in Japan 2006.
So, I don't know, maybe if they stripped the dialogue out of a sequel, you could see it get like...
It really, like, right now, I'm just scrolling through these import games, just like curious to how many of them are going to be mech games, and it's a lot. But it really is depressing how many of these games we never got, because some of them are really, really good, and it's just, for whatever reason, the DS, just thousands of games just never...
It's just so many games. I mean, some of it is just as a percentage of a shitload of games ends up being quite a lot of games.
Yeah, and it just happens to be that there were a lot of games that are actually pretty decent that never made it to the U.S.
Yeah, there was just nobody to really take the chance on them.
Was there a Chibi-Robo for DS? I mean, not Chibi-Robo, Custom Robo.
Yes, there is a Custom Robo for DS.
I mean, on the subject of import games, well, the games that might not be coming over, I should say, look, the fact that they just did a bunch of release dates for the North America territories and didn't have Last Window in it is not a great sign for that.
Oh, that's the Hotel Dusk.
Yeah, the Hotel Dusk sequel.
Yeah, that's not good.
That's coming out in like 4 weeks here.
Yes.
We are not getting
that game. And that's, I mean, I'm not surprised.
I'm not surprised at all. It's too bad. We're getting Ghost Trick, which I'm pretty happy about.
Yeah.
Okie doke. Thanks for listening, everybody. That's New Business. And now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we have your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. Well, this week on the Developer Journal for Flip's Twisted World, we've got Flip's Twisted Evolution Part 1. The lead designer of the game, Douglas Gregory, explains why Flip's Twisted World came to look the way it does and tells the story of the origins of its design. This feature continues to be awesome, and you should check it out.
Another feature we have is Zach's Retro Revival number 3 about Mischief Makers. He gives us his thoughts on this overlooked treasure developed N64 platformer and tells you why you should give it a try if you find a used copy. And in reviews, we have Neil taking on Divergent Shift. He gives us his opinion on this unique puzzle platformer and tells us why it's worth your time, if only for a little while.
That's the 2D platformer where you play on both screens at the same time, and it looks really cool, and it makes me wish I could play DSiWare without having to buy a DSi.
Well, it wouldn't be too much longer, though, would it?
Probably.
In interviews, for some reason, we have an interview about Enjoy Your Massage. Microform's Giovanni Samadi explains why the hell they made this game, and how relaxing the player and enhancing his emotional involvement came into being from a game that was originally designed for sexual gratification.
You need to read this interview. It will shock and appall you.
If anything, it will educate at the very least.
In reviews, we have, this is Nathan's first review, actually. Happy Birthday Mart for the DS, which is a game with a really crappy name. It takes the task of tolerating the, quote, dream shop where you sell goods to your friends, only to find out why your friends are assholes in this Take No Prisoner review.
Again, terrible game, actually a really funny review.
It is a great review.
All right, furthering the review escapades, Pedro gives us his review of Despicable Me for the Wii. He weighs in on the latest movie tie-in and has more positive comments than negative. While not without its flaws, check out his review to find out why this title might just be worth your time. And our last review is I Spy Universe. Matt Blunden takes his DS title out for a spin and find out whether or not this puzzle within a picture game is suited for all tastes by checking it out.
All right, that's just a sampling of the great content we have this week on NintendoWorldReport.com.
Enjoy your massage, people.
Welcome back, everyone. It's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Send us a cool question or comment. You can be read on the show, just like these guys.
David O. from Arrowhead Lake, California writes, "Hey guys, with the new generation of iPod coming up any month, and my old one on the way out, I started wondering if there was any way that I could consolidate my needs to one gadget. In other words, do you think that the Nintendo 3DS will have worthwhile support for MP3 and other media files? And if so, will it be able to play in sleep mode so that it will fit comfortably in your pocket?" Similarly, Matt from Lancaster, Pennsylvania writes, "Hello, gentlemen. Now that we know more about the 3DS hardware and its capabilities, I was wondering what features you feel are missing, and if so, will the missing feature hurt the system long term?"
Yeah, I grouped these together because I think they might go together, might not, but they're similar questions. So the funny thing is, I think there's actually still a lot about the 3DS hardware that we don't know.
Yes, it's a little early to be saying what's been left out, because I think when they talk about it in September in Japan, then we'll know everything about it.
I mean, we've exactly. basically been explicitly told there's at least one major feature we don't know about. No, what Nintendo defines as a major feature is, yeah. is always just completely batshit crazy.
It has, it has two microphones.
Yeah, it's like sometimes major feature is like, oh yeah, and it has, and we've invented motion control. And sometimes it's like, you have a second volume slider on the other side of the unit.
Well, wasn't the big missing feature for the Wii, the big reveal, wasn't it the speaker on the Wii remote?
Yes.
Yeah. That was like the last thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It hasn't worked out great.
That came out about the start of E3, but just before it, because the Red Steel cover story in Game Informer blew it.
Oddly enough, the PDP, I forget what they're called, the miniature remote and nunchuck thing. Neil's reviewing it right now. I haven't talked to him much, so I don't know what he thinks of it. But the guys who are making it told me that they've actually put a better quality speaker in that thing. And so the same games, supposedly, it'll actually sound better just because the hardware itself is improved over what's in the original Wii remote.
Yeah, it's just a cheap speaker. I mean, if you look...
Just shitty. I mean, it's ultra shitty. So, I don't know. I don't know how well that works out. It may not make much of a difference, but I just made me think of it. I think it's very reasonable to expect that 3DS will include some kind of audio support, because DSi has it.
Looking at the trend, it won't be MP3.
No.
All they need is AAC files, guys. You guys are crazy if you think otherwise.
Well, AAC is kind of open source, free. It's unlicensed, so they don't have to pay extra fees.
Nintendo doesn't want to pay a license fee. It's
right. For MP3, they have to pay some amount per system, and they don't want to do that because they don't think of it as a major feature. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they decide to make 3DS more of a multimedia player and really push that side of it, then they would be wise to pay that license fee, probably. But I don't know if they're going to go in that direction.
They actually, and if you remember, they removed MP3 support from the Wii.
Yeah, the photo channel was updated to take it out.
That was an optional update.
But still, they didn't tell you, oh, and this update is going to take away MP3 playback.
They did, James, because if you read the message on your message board, they said that is the only difference.
Oh.
They said, you may choose to upgrade to this and enable AAC support, but if you do, it will no longer play MP3.
Of course, what we could assume is if you bought a new Wii after that change,
you had it
with the preloaded photo channel that had AAC.
I'm sure you're correct.
So yes, they did still remove it from the Wii platform. I am still correct.
But, I mean, what's interesting about it, of course, in terms of the multimedia and all that, is that they've already hinted at the movies part, because they had that at E3, watching bits of 3D movies. And of course, that begs a question about the delivery platform for that kind of stuff.
If they sell 3D movies on DS game cards, they are on crack.
Yeah, that's like going back to GBA.
The GBA videos.
Of Pokemon,
yes.
Didn't work for the PSP, and it's not going to work for the 3DS. If they're going to sell movies to 3DS owners, you've got to do it digitally.
Yep.
And then if you've got a digital delivery content platform of that kind of scale, it begs the question, what else you're going to do with that? Because if the infrastructure's there...
That's not their game. But they've already implied, it's been implied at least by other people, that they have at least spoken to companies like Netflix about devices like the 3DS. So...
Oh. I would jizz in my pants if they announced Netflix.
I don't think they're gonna build their own system, because A, they're not good at that, and B, they don't have experience with these big media distribution systems.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're much more likely to basically sublet that out.
Maybe it'll have the Zune store.
You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if Microsoft would be willing to make that deal.
It's really interesting. I mean, Nintendo has dabbled in media support for their handhelds for a long time. The GBA had the whole Play-On thing.
Yeah.
So, and that was pretty popular in Japan. There was the GBA movie stuff, which Nintendo, they were selling mainly Pokemon stuff, but Majesco had all kinds of licenses.
Nicktoons.
Yeah, a lot of Nickelodeon cartoons, stuff like that.
Right. So they've dabbled in it from time to time. It's never been a very unified platform. It's always been kind of thrown together, it seems like. I think they could very well have a much more robust built-in media content delivery type platform for 3DS. I mean, I think there's a market for that, and especially for kids. I mean, I've talked about it before, how the DSi, I mean, yeah, it has like shitty digital camera in it. It has all this crappy audio recorder stuff. But from what I've seen from my little cousins and people like that, kids actually use those features. I mean, they're not for us. You know, I have a digital camera that takes good photos. My phone takes better photos than the DSi. But for a kid who may not have a cell phone, who may not have their own digital camera, it's very worthwhile to have features like that built into a game system that they want anyway. And, you know, having a decent media player in there, that makes sense. You know, a lot of kids don't have iPods, don't have iPhones, things like that. It makes sense to include that kind of feature for younger kids, basically. And because of that, I think it's unreasonable to expect that it will be a really state-of-the-art, high-quality version.
Yeah, it's not going to be an iPod killer, is it, in terms of...
No.
David's point about having one device. I struggle to see all the functionality being sufficiently robust that you'd be happy with it as your sort of one-stop shop.
Well, if you're used to having an iPod, the 3DS is probably not going to be a very good substitute.
I think the other point, though, is that a lot of one-stop shop devices have issues where they don't always serve all their devices as well as other things.
The PSP is kind of what you're talking about there, where it does play movies and play MP3s and play games. People seem to really like it for that.
And this, well, the suggestion is that the next PSP may be going sort of further in that direction with, you know, the Android stuff being a phone as well.
Yeah, or get an iPad. It does all that stuff too. It's not as portable, obviously, but...
That's understatement of a lifetime.
As far as missing features, I don't think it'll be a whole lot of media stuff. I mean, I think they will announce some kind of digital movie delivery type service, but that they've kind of already hinted at that pretty strongly with the E3 announcements. But I do agree that in September, when they announce the Japanese release date and price, they are going to really let the cat out of the bag, and it probably won't be strictly a hardware feature. I mean, we've held it in our hands, we've played with it, and plus they've said that hardware design is pretty much finalized. So I don't necessarily think there's a hardware feature in there that we haven't seen yet. I think whatever they have to announce about 3DS will be primarily on the kind of firmware side, like software features that are built in.
Yeah.
So stuff like, if you're thinking along the lines of PictoChat, some kind of 3DSware store, virtual console potentially, or virtual handheld service, some kind of service level feature that's built into the system. That very much. And, you know, my prediction from way back is still possible that it has like built in fitness type stuff.
Yeah, it could have like a fitness channel built into the firmware or something. Or just like tracking your steps, your pedometer styles. It's got the accelerometer in there.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we got to really experiment with the accelerometer very much though, so we don't necessarily know how well it works. Because, I mean, not even the, the Face Ace, even that was done with the camera more than the accelerometer.
Yeah, maybe using them together, but it's hard to tell.
I mean, that's kind of what I'm getting at. I was like, well, we don't really know what all the hardware features of the system are capable of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how it works them into applications built into the system, I mean, that could be where we come up with what we don't know yet. Maybe they find ways to do stuff with the 3D pictures the camera can take. Because, I mean, right now, okay, great, you got a 3D picture, but it's still stuck on your fucking 3DS.
Yeah.
So you're going to walk and be like, look at this picture I took.
Well, you just print it out on your 3D printer.
Yeah, just print a little
cube. They do have those if you want to pay for them.
It'd be a really tiny cube based on the resolution.
But I'm thinking maybe there's more to that just a camera. Maybe it can do more than just take a picture of you and be like, yep, that's me in 3D. Here's me in 3D too, by the way, but this isn't on a small screen.
It could also be related to, there was some stuff that was mentioned at the E3 roundtable. It was kind of translated in an odd fashion, or maybe just, you know, maybe the guy just didn't explain it all that well up front, but he mentioned something very vague about how the 3DS might sort of tag up with Wi-Fi hotspots as you come in contact with them and do that automatically, so you wouldn't...
That was in the press conference, too. Tag mode.
No, I'm not talking about tag mode. Tag mode is point-to-point, system-to-system. There was something in the roundtable about, you know, there might be online features that aren't real-time, but they would sort of be stored, and then when you happen to walk by an open Wi-Fi hotspot, it would download and upload stuff automatically. So, for instance, you might be able to access the 3DSware store even if you're not on the internet, because it has what it's done is it has downloaded the latest content listing. You know, so it knows that the shop has been updated and there's all these new games on there. And then you can look at it offline and choose what you want to do and put in your payment information, kind of get all that done, and then
it would download the next time you came across one of these spots.
Yeah, so there'd be content delivery, maybe some kind of, I don't know, blog, like RSS type
stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, all this stuff, like tag modes, or what, I mean, it sounds like the kind of Japanese workaround for persistent online, basically.
Well, I mean, what they have discussed with tag mode and the downloading as you go through hotspots was that, like, content to games you have could be pushed to you as you go through a hotspot, like bonus content. And then you would distribute it if you came around somebody else who had a 3DS.
Yeah, the propagation.
Potentially,
method.
Yes.
It's like spreading a virus, basically.
Really interesting way to do it.
You know, I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but I did a research project similar to that. It's just, this has happened before using RFID tags and, like, managing shipping stuff. It's kind of a weird-ass way for them to come up with it, but I mean...
It seems like it would work okay.
Certainly in Japan.
Somebody there is adventurous.
So to Matt's question about what features are missing, at least so far, that we know of, and that would really hurt the system if they're not announced, unified friend code. I'm okay with a friend code as long as there is one friend code for the entire system. And that applies to every online game. So once you put it in, once I have Greg's friend code put into my system, every new game that we buy, it will automatically be in there with his name on it, and it just works.
Yep.
That will be a disaster if it doesn't have that.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'm hoping with that is that kind of like with DSi, they've moved to a point now where they're kind of incorporating the age rating system into it, so it detects it and you've got parental controls and stuff. So
right. That's pretty standard these days.
Yeah, it's pretty standard these days. I'm just hoping that, you know, with this new system launching with that from scratch, that they're going to feel confident enough in the parental control side to not fudge the friend codes.
But the Wii had parental controls and they just fudged the friend codes.
That was the preface I started with. I mean, it's not just an issue of protecting children, obviously, something to do with the way they configure their online
protecting children from John.
Basically, better integration with Club Nintendo as well, just so you know, when I buy a new game and I pop in the system, it automatically updates it on my Club Nintendo account and, you know, gives me access to whatever. I can fill out the survey on the 3DS and the system knows that I own this game. Nintendo knows that I own this game. That could, again, we've mentioned it before, that could feed into the sort of persistent online identity and still in a secure way that is safe for children, etc. Just, you've got to make all that stuff easier for the player. So, thanks for the questions, guys. The next one is from Adolf in Arlington, Texas. And he asks, do you guys think the multiplayer award system for GoldenEye 007 on N64 will return for the Wii version? I'm talking about the awards at the end of multiplayer matches like Most Cowardly, Most Dishonorable, Marksmanship, etc. I always enjoyed those fun awards at the end of a multiplayer match and would enjoy it if they returned and updated with more creative award titles. Do you guys care about this kind of thing, or have you forgotten about it? I don't think very many modern FPS games have these. Now, when we got this question, John, you were saying that you've played a game that does have these.
Yeah, Modern Warfare 2. Modern Warfare 2 actually has a lot of these, but they aren't as silly as the ones... Well, some of them are, actually.
No, because it's super serious.
Well, some of the ones on Modern Warfare 2, I mean, the one I was laughing about that I see a lot is... they call it Spy Game, because you watch the kill cam the most, which means that you've been killed the most during a match. But yeah, there's a lot of silly ones like that in Modern Warfare 2. But I mean, he's absolutely right, though. A lot of first-person shooters, they don't have stuff like this. They don't really rate your play. Like, they'll give you... I mean, you'll get points for the match, right? But...
they don't describe you.
But yeah. Brawl and Melee have this, though. They're not FPSs, but they do.
They do, basically, yeah. They have those...
did Brawl still have it?
I think it did.
I know Melee does, but it has those bonus titles at the end.
There were some that were really specific.
Yeah, it's like right. Mr. Smashed with four times with the baseball bats.
Oh, there was one that you could only get if you killed someone with Luigi's taunt.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Which is very difficult to do, because it does like 1%, and it has almost no range. And, you know, Perfect Dark had these, not surprising. It's, you know, same developer as GoldenEye. But from what I remember at E3, I do think the new GoldenEye has these.
I can't remember because I was too pissed at having blown a 4-kill lead over Carly to keep track of what happened at the end. I'm like, I got you, I got
game.
You, and then boom, damn it.
I can't say as I noticed when I was playing, unfortunately, I wasn't looking for. I kind of completely forgot about them until this email brought them back up again. But it was a little amusing. Sort of. The thing is, sometimes it was just amusing because you'd have a particularly nondescript game, and it's like, what bullshit is it going to come up with?
Right. Just boring.
Like,
yeah.
You know, everyone kind of did about the same. There wasn't anything extraordinary. And then people get really disparate awards, and it's like, okay. And then other times it was like, yes, that's deeply appropriate for what your unscrupulous tactics.
I remember I played a game of Perfect Dark where my cousin and I used to play every weekend when we'd get together on Sundays, and we basically trained against Dark Sims all the time.
Oh, like, God.
Like during the week, we would just train against one Dark Sim, and then we could both dominate a single Dark Sim.
And you were playing inside of a spaceship that had enhanced gravity so that you would build up more muscle when you got out.
Yes, exactly. Well, what would happen is we would get together and we'd try to fight three of them, which would be death.
I can only imagine.
You would be harvest like wheat.
I used to just try to survive, see how long I could survive against Dark Sims. Like, can I live for 1 minute? I wouldn't even shoot at them. I'd just run away
just
and see
run.
How long I could
Can you imagine if they had Dark Sims in GoldenEye so you had the music all the time? It's like,
So what we found, though, is one time, because we actually beat three Dark Sims. We're like, yes, we're awesome. We're like, let's put four on there. And then all the titles we got were about how terrible we were destroyed. It was like Mr. Worthless.
I mean, Perfect Dark was awesome for messing around with. Although one thing we used to do, because you could order the Sims about, we'd have some sort of weird team game, and we'd order a Sim towards us, load him up with remote mines, and then tell him to go and fight one of the Sims and wait for the radar dots to converge, and then and then it just comes up, normal Sim killed, hard Sim killed, hard Sim killed. Poor guys. Oh, it was awesome.
The best, though, was in that game, like, I think there was a title for using, like, the laptop gun a lot.
Yeah.
Like whenever you played Dark Sims, you just throw them out in the hallway and hide in a closet and wait for them to step into them. And, like, you're like, yeah, I got this bastard. And all of a sudden, you'd be shot through the closet with the Farsight. And you're like, fuck these guys.
Why have the Farsight on in the first place?
And then you'd get a title about how you've been hiding in a closet. It's like, oh, I died.
Just like R. Kelly.
Yeah, it's epic. Oh my God, the hip opera.
Yes, the
hip opera. Oh my God,
it's so good.
James, you've got the no, John's got
the next
one. I
don't. I've already read my questions.
All right, Max writes, why do you think the Nintendo games rarely, if ever, have a limited edition version that you can buy for a little extra change, or more likely, double the amount of the game, i.e. Halo Reach or StarCraft? Well, I hope you read my letter. By the way, I'm the guy who rage messaged you about picking some other Zelda game instead of Wind Waker for game of the decade. So I decided to send you a nice letter and tell you guys how awesome you are.
Now, you're right the first time, dude. You were totally up on this the first time. But because they already make enough money, probably it's not worth their time.
Yeah, I think limited edition games, first off, I think they're stupid. That's my personal opinion.
Wait. We really need to let John discuss this first, because he is the expert.
Yeah, John actually buys them.
Yeah, I've been on a number of them. The thing is, the problem that I have with them now is that they're either just totally useless swag, I mean, completely fucking useless, or just like art books and shit. The thing is, like, I think much like, you know, stuff like Rock Band, you buy some of those things, and eventually you just have so much garbage laying around your house, you just don't want anything anymore.
How about night vision goggles?
Well, that's the thing. That's my point. It's like there's only so many, like, you know, like I think the Call of Duty Black Ops, there's like a remote control car. I mean, you know, there's like art books.
Yeah, I mean, art books, I could, in some cases, I could see that if you're a big fan, maybe that could be. It seems a lot more worthwhile. I think apparently the Castlevania Lords of Shadow special edition in Europe comes with a mask.
On that mask, is there a picture of flying coffins with tentacles coming out? Because there needs to be.
There's just, yeah, there's so much stupid crap. I think there's a version of the Big Lebowski that comes with a bathrobe.
Really?
Yeah.
Look, that Big Lebowski is probably my favorite movie of all time, but am I going to buy a special edition with that kind of No, I just want it on Blu-ray.
It should have just come with a ferret.
It's not on Blu-ray, and that's for a different podcast, but...
I think the point is, look, this tactic is essentially price discrimination. It's a way of you change the package up a little bit, and it's a way of improving your margins and getting people who are willing to pay more for a game, essentially, to actually pay more.
Right, because most people are willing to pay less for a game, but there's like 10% of your market...
named John Lindemann.
...that is willing to pay basically any price to get this.
But see, I'm not sure how much the profit margin goes up, though, because they have to put all this
crap.
Always,
that's the point. I mean,
it serves a secondary promotional purpose, too, that Nintendo doesn't need to fill because their shit gets promoted unless it's ExciteBots.
Well, the thing is, too, you have to realize that I think a lot of these things are ways for them to get more money out of the same game that Nintendo doesn't really have to do because, frankly, their games cost a lot less to make than a lot of these other, you know, HD titles.
I mean, I suppose also there is the issue of kind of market they're aiming for. I mean, there's definitely a sort of area, you know, if you're hardcore Nintendo fans that probably would be willing to part with more of their money.
They're called our staff.
To play their favorite games. I mean, I've been doing that for quite a while because I play import games, and you know, certainly did that with Sin and Punishment too.
But you're still paying for the game itself. I mean, I think about it in terms of, let's say, Metroid, okay? One of my favorite game series, or Zelda as well. I mean, these are series that I love more than all others, and yet, would I buy a limited edition $80 copy of Zelda Skyward Sword? No, because I'm really, really excited for that game, but I'm excited for that game. The game costs a certain amount, and I'm not interested in all the extra shit they're going to throw in.
I think it would depend on what that shit is.
Well, John, all right, so let's do it for you. All right, so it's Zelda Skyward Sword. It's $80, but you get a dream date with Miyamoto. Do you pay for it? we're talking nice dinner, beach, romantic comedy.
Will you give me tongue? That's my question.
Oh, God. What can you put in a package for $20 to $30 extra that is actually worth it and is unique to that game? I mean, the night vision goggles thing with Modern Warfare 2, so strange because you can buy night vision goggles separately.
It's
not like you can only get those with that game. Yeah. So it's just a really strange thing
to
put in there.
Here's what, and this has actually happened, so I'm pointing it out. Although it was a pre-order bonus. When they released Ocarina of Time and Master Quest with the pre-order bonus of Wind Waker, if they had had a version of Wind Waker that was $10 to $15 more and included those discs, I would have paid it.
Okay, but you're paying for extra games.
But still, but it's not that game. I mean, it's games.
No, but you're paying for games. That's the thing. When I buy games, I'm paying for games. I don't really want to pay for a bunch of other bullshit that's related
to
games.
It's not like statues of Big Daddies,
right,
or a Star
I'm happy
screen
to take
toy
a free T-shirt if it comes with a pre-order. But I don't want to pay $20 extra for a version that comes with a T-shirt because I could probably buy that T-shirt separately.
Yeah,
and I probably don't want it anyway.
Like I said, and usually a lot of the time, I think limited editions are, you know, like you said, they're pretty much constrained to be kind of rubbish because obviously there's only so far they can go above the
right.
The
they're not
going to
sell. They're not going to charge $200 for it because then.
And then, as I said,
they
do it to improve their margins. So you're within that additional sort of premium, you're going to be talking about something that's worth less than that.
Ultimately, you're just not getting a very good deal if you buy a limited edition because they're putting
typically
cheap stuff
not
in there and charging you a lot more than it's worth.
Like I said, I mean, you could talk about an art book or something, but if you really love that series. I mean, that's one of the things that I could imagine. First of all, it doesn't occupy a bunch of space like some of this tablet.
True.
And second of all, you know, it is specific to that game. It's about that game's world or whatever. I mean, I could see, if you are a really big fan, I could see that being worth it on a case-by-case basis. But, I mean, other than that, it's tough. I mean, and so I don't know. I mean, you know, it does seem a bit of a pass by Nintendo in terms of, as I said, I do believe there is the possibility to, even though it's not necessarily a huge percentage of the market that they sell to, that would be willing to pay this premium. So I believe that it exists. So it's kind of interesting that they they don't it. They kind of forego that revenue generating opportunity. But I mean, as John says, it's certainly not imperative for them to do so, given the kinds of
game. See, what I've noticed recently, though, is like right now, there is still BioShock 2 big stupid versions sitting in, on the racks in Best Buy, taking up a lot of space.
Yep.
And I have to imagine the retailers hate those because they take up a lot of space.
Yeah.
They're still sitting there. That game came out, what?
February.
Yeah, it's been a long fucking time. And they only ship one package of those. I remember seeing the Halo ones that had the remote control Warthog. And that shit was around forever. And the, I don't know, those are the ones that had the big stupid helmets.
The cat helmet.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they actually sell that well. So, I mean, Nintendo might just say, well, all we're going to do is piss off retailers by making this big dumb thing.
It does have the smell. It has the stink of a fad, right? Like a retail fad. And it maybe it's going away.
Well, also the fact, you have to think, too, like the games that they, like games drop in price so quickly now. I mean, not you're getting really, really screwed.
That they do, except for Nintendo games, which never drop in price.
Maybe that's one of the reasons is that Nintendo's versions, because they're not split up into multiple editions and all that crap, you know, it's...
Yeah, well, that's the thing. They usually are very much against splitting the market until they got to Wii Motion Plus and DSi, but...
And then they're like, fuck it, let's do it!
I mean, one of the things when you split up among multiple versions is you end up with extra supply because you have to... The retailer has to stock the game twice at the same time. And that's what... That may be contributing to these prices going down because they end up with too many on the shelves and they have to get rid of them. So it could actually do the opposite of what they want it to do.
Yeah.
As you said, I mean, you know, it is a sort of experiment in price discrimination, and in terms of how effective that is in actually extracting more revenue, I mean, you'd have to do an empirical study to verify that one way or the other. But clearly, Nintendo is not convinced of its efficacy.
Let's say this: it is conceivable. Although I cannot contrive the circumstances that would cause it. But it is conceivable that at one point I might buy a special edition of a Nintendo game under certain circumstances. Now, if, say, Atlus were to come along and say, we're going to make a new Ogre Battle game, but we're only going to have a $500 version of it, I'd be like, fuck you, Atlus. Here's my money. I mean, I would write them an angry letter, but I would also send them a large check.
Oh, gosh. Well, the one time that I can think of where Nintendo's actually done this is with Metroid Prime Trilogy last year. And the really great thing about that is that that was the only version. So it cost the same. They just packaged it up nicer. And they gave you the art book. And they gave you the poster. And they gave you the nice metal case. But that's all there was.
And they also gave us a whole weekend of comedy of watching Chezza get pissed at Metroid Prime 2.
Yes. Oh, man, that was epic. So the really nice thing about that is I think it was a rare case of where the packaging actually fit the game. Because if you think about it, the trilogy is basically already a special edition of these three games. They're being packaged together. They're being enhanced. There's already, like, new bonus art and stuff like that in the game itself. So really all Nintendo did was just design a package that kind of fit the game really well. And if you think about it, going way, way, way back, they've done that with things like Zelda, where they release a gold cartridge and a gold box. But it just goes with the game. It doesn't cost more. It's not really limited edition.
In the case of the Zelda ones, though, they were just temporary. They were like, if you pre-ordered
the
game...
Like the first shipment was the gold cartridge, and after that, you may or may not get one. You know, they're not against doing that. I mean, you've got the red boxes for New Super Mario Brothers and stuff like that. So they're not against messing around with the packaging, but they're not tiering it. They're not splitting the market up when they do it. So I actually really, really like the way Nintendo does it. They don't do it a lot, but when they do it, I feel like they do it the right way. Well, there you go. I hope we addressed the question there. And Greg has the last letter.
Yep. Joel from Western Australia writes, I've been listening to your fine podcast. It's episode 1. It was actually my introduction to podcasts in general. While I now realise that it was pretty rough around the edges, at the time I was just happy to hear conversations about my favourite games company. Gotta say, the current team is excellent. You guys mesh together really well.
Damn it.
When I was a kid, I borrowed a copy of The Legend of Zelda for the NES from a friend. I made it to the final dungeon, but didn't beat Ganon before I had to return the game. I've finished every Zelda game since, so my failure to complete the original has been bugging me more and more over the past 20 years. This month, I finally snapped and eBayed a copy of Legend of Zelda and completed the sucker. My question is simple. How important is closure in games to you?
John Lindemann.
Not important whatsoever. Closure over a 20-year period? I can see that. Maybe.
Interesting question, this one.
Yes, very.
I think there's been a recent discussion on this about the 240-second star in Mario Galaxy 2.
Yeah.
Fuck!
Greg the Punisher Leahy.
It was sufficiently important to me to get it done, because I have got every star in every 3D Mario game.
Ugh.
You masochist.
I've gone to lengths to get every Master Cup in F-Zero games. If it's a series I really love, it becomes important to me.
Does that include Mario 64 DS? Because if it doesn't,
no,
you're going to need to drop a title.
I'll concede that one. Unfortunately, the 30 extra stars were not picked up because I didn't own that game.
Oh.
You didn't miss much.
He missed Yoshi. Come on.
Yeah, Yoshi's there. Wario's there. You know, but and it never just for the sake of it. You know, I mean, but it's sort of in the context he's talking about, sort of a whole series, I can kind of see it personally. But, I mean, one of the things that kind of tempers it these days for me, that I've perceived, is just the amount of really excellent games that I've played recently that have bad endings. I mean, recent games that I've finished that I've otherwise really, really enjoyed, like Arkham Asylum, Uncharted 2, Assassin's Creed 2, the last fight. I mean, the actual plot resolution is fine, but yeah, the last boss fight,
it's annoying.
I thought it was utterly embarrassingly poor.
Yeah.
It's annoying, and Uncharted 2 has a very annoying end sequence, but it is at least really impressive. I mean, it's very whiz-bang, it's wow factor.
But, I mean, but even the end boss is just kind of like, this is the end boss? Really?
I think actually boss encounter design is a fading art in video game development.
Treasure, they're carrying the flame.
Yeah, I mean, every boss in a treasure game is exciting. But I mean, in terms of like ending the game on a really big, cool note, making the player feel like, I've arrived, this is the shit.
Yeah.
A lot of games, unfortunately, just kind of take the same things you've been doing before and make them more annoying. And that's that's the final boss, and it sucks.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's just something about development cycles now as such that, you know, everyone's working really hard to get it out by a certain date. Maybe I think Adam Sessler talked about this on a Sessler soapbox quite recently with respect to Mass Effect 2, but they're working really hard to get the game out in time, and if the ending is one of the last things that gets done, that may be where some of the shortfall comes on an otherwise excellent game. And I think the point that I'm making is that, you know, the more excellent games you have that have kind of weak endings, the less important closure is getting to be.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not like, oh, you've got to see the end because the end's probably going to be awesome. It's like, well, no,
yeah,
even if the rest of the game's awesome, it's probably going to be a bit of a letdown.
Yeah.
I mean, we talked to, I know, Johnny, you weren't too impressed with the final Bowser fight in Galaxy 2.
Which is the same as the first Bowser fight.
It's so similar.
Exactly. It's not a bad fight. It's just exactly the same as before, except slightly more annoying.
I mean, that's really weird because there's plenty of boss fights in that game to go around.
Well, I mean, it alternates. So it's Bowser and Bowser Jr. And the Bowser Jr. fights are creative. And
yeah, they're different.
Right.
I
think that was just EAD Tokyo thinking that they were kind of doing some kind of poetic repetition where each one would build on itself and it would feel, I don't know, it just didn't work.
As I said before, I think some of it's slavish adherence to previous conventions as well.
Yeah,
which is completely unnecessary.
Well, for me, the issue of closure has become a big one in the past few years, and it's not because game endings are bad, although that's a great point. For me, it's just the amount of games that I play now has really, really increased as I've gone more and more multi-platform. Now I've got PC games and PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360 and Wii and DS.
DS, which has just got so many games onto itself.
Oh, I know. Yep. It's just, it seems like, and with all the download platforms, it's so easy to acquire interesting new games for little money, and they come out every week. It's just a relentless onslaught of new games, new games, new games. And one of the things that I've had to give up, aside from a lot of money, of course, is I've had to give up finishing games. I rarely, rarely finish games anymore. And maybe it's because, you know, games tend to not end well, as Greg says. But for me, I would rather start a new game and at least sample a different experience than play twice as much of one that I'm already familiar with just to say I've finished it.
Hear, 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 hear. Bravo, Johnny, bravo.
I mean, obviously this is, I mean, I think to some extent on Wii, maybe this is a bigger problem because Wii doesn't have, like, achievements and stuff. Like, some people might play to the end just for these. I know you wouldn't,
right.
Johnny, but I'm just, so
well,
some people
achievements
might.
Are, like, a very mild form of motivation to actually, if I'm already 90% of the way through the game, the achievement might be just the little tiny push I need to say, you know what, I might as well go ahead and finish it. Whereas with a Wii game, there are times when I get 90% through and I'm like, okay, whatever.
Well, considering I'm the opposite person, I'm the completest of my games. It for me, it's not so much that it's about beating the game senseless. It's about if I run into something that is challenging me, it's really pushing me, I want to
overcome it.
You're right. So I think
you
we're
call me a quitter.
But I think if we're discussing bad endings, I've touched on this the score or in the show. Vesperia has a terrible ending. Tales of Vesperia, yeah. Because completing a side quest gets you a harder boss that they don't anticipate you being able to beat. They expect you to come around so you can save a lot of your upgrades when you do Game Plus. They expect you to come back and beat him on Game Plus in the harder boss. So I basically got my shit rocked. So I could have just dropped it and gone like, fuck this, I'm done. Because there's no way to get the normal boss. And I went through and just beat myself senseless till I got it and then got a shitty ending. Which I knew was going to happen, but god damn it, he was there and he was going down.
You know, that's too bad because actually Tales of Symphonia had a pretty cool ending. I was very satisfied with that movie at the end.
It's a cool movie at the end, but you're like, well, what did we just do?
No, I mean, for me, it's just that, you know, being younger, finishing games is really important to me. And first of all, if you import game and all that, you ain't got many games. So you want, you know, if you're going to finish, even if it's super R-type, bloody hell, you're gonna try and finish it.
You're going to try. Yeah. You won't, but you're going to try.
So finishing them, the act to finishing them was important to me, but also the finale itself was important to me. You know, games that had awesome finales really did leave a much better taste in my mouth. Your Contra 3 has a ridiculously epic finale. Overcoming that is tremendously satisfying. It's spectacular. And, you know, that leaves a much better impression than something like Castlevania 4, which is awesome, but it kind of ends on a bit of a damp squib of a final boss. So, I mean, those things really mattered to me back then. Whereas now, they don't matter so much. And I think some of that is just, you know, maybe, you know, the change in myself, and some of it is the change in games. And I think the point that Johnny raised is important because a greater percentage of gamers now are people that are playing like Johnny does, you know, a whole bunch of games across a whole bunch of different platforms, different kinds of experiences. I don't know how concerned developers are about players actually finishing it necessarily. You know, I don't know whether it's at the top of their list, like, okay, we've got to give them something awesome at the end because, you know, they've probably got data about how many of the players actually get to the end and all sorts of things. So on the cost-benefit basis, it may not even be simply economic to justify putting the effort.
I'm sure it depends heavily on what kind of game it is, too. I mean,
of course.
Sure. I mean, yeah. Well, look, Red Steel, we talked about last week, that game is less than 10 hours long, and I couldn't be bothered to finish it.
Yeah.
Because I got to a point where I was like, I feel like I've gotten everything I'm getting out of this. It's time to move on to something else.
Well, in that case, it's just so repetitive. You're like, well,
it's not even just that. It's just like, I felt like
You've seen everything.
I've played this game. I feel like I can talk about this on the podcast, and I can tell people what I think about it, and I'll be informed.
And then the sort of the so-called closure of actually literally seeing everything that's in the game is trivial.
Yeah. Well, especially now with achievements, too, I feel like it's kind of cheapened. I mean, it's made it even more...
Cheapened.
Well, not cheapened, but it's made it even harder to get everything you can possibly get out of a game, you know? So
if you're like an achievement closure whore.
One of the achievements for Res HD is to get 100% of the upgrades and kill 100% of the enemies on screen on all stages.
It's like, I don't even want to do that. You know?
One of the screens is just like an entire wave of shit. It's like, you can't. It's impossible. It can't be done.
That's just crazy.
Yeah.
No, you're right, John. I mean, there are games where sometimes on my Xbox games, I'll look at the achievement list and think, I could probably get all of these with just a little bit of extra effort.
Oh, Avatar.
No, Geometry Wars 2 actually was one where I played through, you know, I sort of unlocked everything, and then I look at the achievement list and I'm like, oh, this one I can get pretty easily. Well, maybe not, but I can get it. This one I can get with a little bit of effort. You know, this one I'm not so sure about, but it seems feasible. And then there are games where you look at the achievement list, it's like, there's no way. I'd have to play through the entire game like five times.
My favorites are the ones where the achievement list is just question mark. You're like, well, fuck.
Yeah, those are annoying.
But even the ones that where you could get them, what's the point? Really?
Yeah.
Your gamer cred, John. You don't
if
have
you
any
set
cred.
The bar, if you set the bar for like total completionists like so high, then there's a kind of backward induction. You're like, well, I'm never going to really get 100%. So you never even, you might not even shoot as high as you might otherwise do, because it's just like, well, I can't get everything, so there's no point even
sort of
setting
out. That's what I did with Galaxy 2. I'm like, there's no reason for me to go after all these damn stars. I mean, I'll never get them all.
Yep.
And for the same reason, I stopped basically, you know, when there were still stars, I probably could have gotten with some work.
Sure.
But not killing myself, because I was like, well, there's no chance in me to hell of ever getting the rest of these guys.
If for me, I think the question of when to stop playing a game for me comes down to a balance between how motivated am I by what the game is giving me right now? Like, how good is the pacing? How strongly do I feel that I want to keep playing versus what other games are out there that I want to play next? And once the motivation factor of what I'm doing at the moment dies down enough that I feel like I'm losing momentum, I will pretty quickly switch off to something else. And honestly, the end game stuff, like the stuff, the kind of cloud of uncertainty out beyond where I am in the game doesn't really factor into it. Like, that stuff, I'll get to it if I get to it, but that's not really an attractive feature for me.
If the momentum carries you there, you'll do
it. If I get to it, cool, I'll get to see what that stuff is, but I don't know what it is.
It's interesting because, I mean, the countervailing kind of force to what we've talked about with the way games are now, you know, the maybe games are more front-loaded now and things like that, is that, you know, because they're more plot-dependent, you might think that that would actually act as more of a driving force to keep you playing because you just want to see the resolution of the story that's been...
It can if the plot's really good.
The thing is, I'm not a big story guy.
I'm not either, but in the case of like Uncharted 2, for instance, that was one reason that I finished that game.
Yeah, I mean,
the story is pretty good,
that.
And Batman as well.
Yeah.
I actually finished Batman because I liked the story. I liked where it was going. But yeah, most games, that's not a factor.
That's the thing. See, I mean, for like I said, I'm not a big story guy, but I guess in some cases, a lot of games have stories, but they kind of feel incidental.
Well, like in Dragon Quest IX, as I was saying before, I mean, the story...
Yeah, it sounds pretty incidental to me.
It really is, you know, and if I finish that game, it will be because all the grinding and doing all the quests and everything, I just wanted to keep doing that, and I kind of finish the story in the process. But I'm not going to finish that game because I want to see what happens at the end.
I mean, you know, you probably save the world. That's just a wild guess, but you probably do.
Yeah, I mean, this will come into play, I think, with like the new Zelda, for instance, you know, when we start learning more about the story of that game, and it's like, am I going to care? Is that going to be the reason I finish it? I mean, a lot of people didn't finish Twilight Princess. I know that a lot of people didn't. They
heresy.
Just got bored with it.
Well, if you don't make it to the Light Temple in Twilight Princess, you've missed the game's best part. I mean, past that point, I remember it was just like...
The Light Temple?
Which one is the Light Temple?
Oh, the Temple of Time.
Yes.
Oh, with the statue that you're moving around?
Well, the level itself, but just the effect of going into that level. But I mean, I remember after that going, the rest of this doesn't really stack up to what we already saw.
Yeah, I think the Sky Temple in that game wasn't as impressive as they thought it would be.
Yeah, but
I kind of got that sense that they thought this would be like really majestic and, oh, now you're in the sky, but it doesn't really come across all that well.
But I think right now, when I finish a game, and I've actually passed on finishing a few games lately.
Oh, he's growing up.
Well, it's Red Steel. I mean, we've already discussed I can't play that game anymore.
Yeah, if only you'd said that about Mystery Dungeon.
Well.
Yeah, Dave was contractually obligated.
That's right. I had a job to do. I mean, part of that review was, how long is this damn game? Yeah. Holy shit.
And then how long is the post-game?
I considered it, why is there a second game here? What's going on?
It's like the nightmare world where Jimmy, Howie, and Terry actually goes on for 3 hours. Like,
oh no! You mean the West Coast where the games are locked out for the East Coast stuff? Oh god!
Over my head.
He's talking about Fox NFL.
Jimmy fucking Johnson. Bane of my existence before Belichick. He was the first Dark Lord, Morgoth, before Sauron.
Holy crap.
John, we didn't hear a whole lot from you on this.
Because John never finishes games.
I know this is a topic that you have some feelings on, so could you elaborate for us?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, with me, it's like, I find that there's so many games out there, especially with all the platforms I have, there's just so many games that I get interested in, and then 2 weeks go by, and then the next game comes out, and then another week goes by, and another game comes out, and it's just so easy for me now to completely abandon games. I mean, you know, I'm the king of unfinished games completely.
John, do you feel, I've heard some people say that they feel like they're, at this point, there are actually too many games.
I think there are now.
Do you think that's true?
I absolutely think there are. Well, and there's a lot of times where I'll sit back and I'll look at a certain game that's coming out. You know, it could be an RPG, it could be a first-person shooter, anything like that. And I'll look at it and I'll say, wow, you know, that's probably a really good game. Like something like I was the other day, like when I picked up Little Big Planet, another game that was really cheap there was Red Faction. That I've heard only good things about, and I'm sure it's an amazing game, but I just looked at it and I said, you know what? I would never play that, even though it's perfectly good. And it just makes me wonder why game companies think that their games are going to sell. It kind of amazes me that there are so many good games out there now.
Because if you don't think your game is going to sell, you're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I know,
company.
But realistically, though, like on the market, like, I mean.
Well, some of these MMOs that are getting announced all the time, it's really? What do you think? Who is the market for that?
I don't know. Maybe it's just a risk-reward thing from the point of view that they think, well, yes, we know that X number of games that come out in a certain span aren't going to sell, but we're hoping we're going to be the lucky ones. You know?
Yeah, right.
We have some like Borderlands, which kind of seem to sell against expectations rather than stuff that does actually fall between the cracks.
Well,
and
you mean like APB, which is like...
Well, it's just bankrupted the company.
Which is the company ceases to exist now.
Is that right? Real Time Worlds is gone?
It's into administration.
They laid off a huge number of employees.
You know, I hope maybe Ruffian will hire some of those guys and make a better Crackdown 3.
It just really makes me wonder. I mean, I just think that there's a glut of games overall right now. Not that there's going to be some crash or something, but I'm just really surprised that some people just even green light. Like, yeah, we need another military first-person shooter. Really?
Well, I mean, if
nobody
you
else
didn't
does.
Make the, look, if you didn't make that, Activision would cease to exist.
But I mean, seriously, though, like with something like that, I mean, like Medal of Honor, come on.
Yeah, that game does not need to exist.
At least it's got some brand cachet behind it. I mean, it's a
I think Medal of Honor is going to crash and burn. I really do.
Gray and brown.
I think it's fucked, and it's really boring. It's a game, we saw that at E3, and I was like, ugh.
Wait, what game were you looking at? That was the game where, like, what game is this?
Yeah, you know, I have heard, you see these news reports occasionally now where a few of the publishers are talking about how they're going to reduce their portfolio. They're going to concentrate on making fewer, better games. EA did that a few years ago, and I think they're starting to balloon back up now. But they did, you know, EA did kind of trim down at one point.
They cut by like 40% the number of games.
And of course, a lot of what's, you know, and a lot of developers that are doing belt tightening, the first thing to go is original IP.
Yeah, that's the unfortunate thing.
But see, what was funny is EA did the opposite. They said, we're going to cut the number of games.
Yeah. EA really did it the right way. And you know, some of their stuff didn't work out. I mean, Mirror's Edge was kind of a failed experiment, but God bless them for trying.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a game I can't sort out my feelings for, but I'm so glad it was made.
I am too, and I want them to do another one and fix it.
I picked that up for £5, so I'm very pleased that everything that led to that eventuality for me picking up that game for less than the price of a Super NES virtual console.
Yeah,
that's just messed up. I mean,
I can't wait to hear what you think. It's a weird game. It's crazy, but. Yeah, I mean, I think Sega has pretty much shut down their American development stuff, which
kinda, yeah,
needed to be done. I think it's probably a good thing. I mean, the thing is, as it becomes easier to start up a small developer and make a small game, there's more and more games on the bottom end. You probably need to trim down a little on the top because it was just getting really top heavy with these publishers putting out giant portfolios of games.
And there's the other issue, which I know Pact is very fond of bringing up.
Oh, no.
Which is the idea that some of these multiplayer shooters and things like that are so popular over a length of time as well that they're really limiting sort of the appetite of some gamers for more games. You know, because there's just so much value to be had out of that kind of experience over an extended period of time. Well,
and it's the opposite effect on me, because what that means is that there's so many multiplayer games that I don't actually play any of them. Like, I'll buy the game and I'll play it, but a week later there's another one and now I want to go play that, and so I end up kind of focusing on the single player stuff. I mean, I play StarCraft 2 single player, Modern Warfare 2 single player. I end up never really dabbling into the multiplayer because I know I'm not going to be immersed in it for long enough to really get good at it.
To make it worthwhile.
Yeah. I'm not really motivated to jump in that to something
like
that.
That's why with first-person shooters, that's why I say it's like, man, I mean, okay, so like the only first-person shooter I need right now is Modern Warfare 2. Why? Because every other first-person shooter, if I play it online, I'm just going to suck at it because I'm going to put no time into it. So what's the point?
See, here's how I can prove the flaw in that theory. It's that Pachter espoused it, which pretty much means it's wrong. But the concern that he extends off of that is the idea that maybe they need to put subscription models on these first-person shooters. Because that was that, then, you know, we had that whole conversation of, well, could we make a Call of Duty that has a pay-to-play model? But I think that's kind of going to kill its own popularity. What I find interesting about the idea that multiplayer games erode the sales of other games is the assumption that it's the same market that buys these games that would buy other similar games, because I'm not sure you're going to be able to say the guy who plays Call of Duty 2 for 300 hours would buy, you know.
Well, but I suppose what there is if it's kind of a stock flow thought that certain players on the margin may transition into being that kind of player that just plays the multiplayer of a single game, whereas potentially he could have been the kind of player that would be, you know, a bit more of a sort of broad palette.
Yeah, but that's...
So, I mean, I agree. I think there's definitely hardcores that, you know, never the twain shall meet, but there's always that group at the margin, and when you add all those people up and the kind of revenue that would accrue and all that, it becomes significant.
I wonder if this model works on the Wii. Are we going to have a group of online players who float from Conduit 2 to GoldenEye to Call of Duty Black Ops, and they just kind of, they all like migrate, and so one game just kind of empties out as the next one comes out? And
no, because it's online on the Wii.
Well, it's just weird. You've got three online first-person shooters coming out.
On a system that's online is questionable at best.
Right, yeah. And they're all coming out very close to each other.
And I suppose it's a powerful argument for oversaturation in general.
Yeah, even the Wii is getting three different first-person shooters with online in 3 months. That's pretty crazy. Yeah. I might have had them out of order, but they are. I think they're all still expected to come out this year. Anyway, we've moved pretty far out from closure, I guess, but...
Yeah, so funnily enough, we actually moved further away from closure from the point of view of ending the episode.
That's right. All right, well, thanks everybody for writing in. The email address, once again, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Keep them coming in. We keep on riffing on your emails, RFN. And, of course, as we like to remind you from time to time, we are listed on iTunes. If you look us up on there, you can give us like a star rating and write a little review, and it helps other people find the show, which means we get more emails and more fans on Facebook. Just search for Radio Free Nintendo. A lot of funny little discussions there. We put up some photos from the PAX East gathering. I have a photo of the Magic Cast.
Oh, God.
On our Facebook page. So you can actually see us and there are microphones in the middle of the table. You can see us recording that thing. There's
that
also a picture of us at the panel itself doing that show. So we don't have many photos of us together because we record this over the internet 99% of the time, but I tried to find as many as I could. Anyway, check that out. It's on Facebook. Review us on iTunes. sister podcast. We got the NWR newscast. There will be a new episode by the time this goes out. Radio Trivia, there's a new one of those out with Andy. And for some reason, we made it through like 75 episodes, 75 plus episodes of Radio Trivia without playing Zelda 2 music. And even if you don't like Zelda 2, I think you can agree that the music is pretty awesome in that game. So check out Radio Trivia, listen to it, hear those guys, Andy and TYP, talk about the game. Finally, I will pimp a side project. Box Office Poison Episode 2 has been recorded. I don't know when it's going up. It should be hopefully around the time that this episode goes up. So if you want to hear me and a bunch of RFN alumni like Carl and Evan and Stan talk about movies, including Caligula this month.
Oh, this is it. Finally.
Yes.
The terrible pile.
Caligula getting...
It is epic.
I think the payoff is kind of soon, though. I mean, go string that out.
No, but he brought that up on this show 2 years ago.
I know, that's right. But still, it's just... episode 2, I mean, where are you going to go from Caligula?
Yeah, I don't... That's a damn good question. No, actually...
Straight to hell.
The next one after that is... Actually, James, I think you'll appreciate this. We're following up Caligula with Jesus Christ Superstar.
Oh, my God. Right.
Which I've never seen. I'm
just cleansing the palate.
Wait. Is that the Donny Osmond version?
I don't know. I have no idea.
You might kill yourself with the disc.
I'm not
it's
very
over.
Familiar with this film.
Oh, it's so horrible.
So anyway, episode 2 of Box Office Poison should be up very soon. You can search Crosstalk on iTunes. That's TAWK Crosstalk, or go to crosstalk.com and find it there. I think you will enjoy the conversation. All right, that's all. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Later.
Bye.
So long.
Hey, John, think Enjoy Your Massage is done yet?
Probably is.
Yay.
I love that your wife was there to see that thing come in.
Yeah, well, she was just like...
That's beautiful. That's better than I could have ever imagined.
James sent you a massage.
I think I described it as, it's if you ever wanted to learn to be a masseuse or play Simon on the back of a poorly drawn woman. Right. the squish faces. I was dying with the squish faces. And then when I read the interview and saw why, I was beside myself. Like whenever you play Dark Sims, you just throw them out in the hallway and hide in a closet and wait for them to step into them. And like, you're like, yeah, I got this bastard. And all of a sudden, you'd be shot through the closet with the Farsight. And you're like, fuck these guys.
On the way of the Farsight on in the first place.
And then you'd get a title about how you've been hiding in a closet. It's like, oh, I died.
Just like R. Kelly.
Yeah, it's epic. Oh my god, the hip opera.
Yes, the
hip opera. Oh my god.
It's so good.
Something Awful used to have this great, like, super serious, tongue-in-cheek write-up of each new episode of Trapped in the Closet, where
this
they like explained it. They were had all these charts where they were drawing lines that connect all the different characters and how they were related and how they knew each other and trying to untangle the ridiculous plot.
I've just seen the one clip where he discovers a midget under the kitchen sink.
Didn't they basically finish it and then they decided to like unfinish it so they could make more episodes of it?
If there's one thing I've ever seen that made me want whether I actually am in a coma and I'm imagining everything, it was that.
It was that bad. Oh, it really was.
Oh, God. Okay, well, all that's going to get cut out, but.
You could find its way in at the end.